This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Lynn Malcolm with you for All in the Mind. Today, still in the spirit of Sigmund Freud and his 150th birthday, we examine the evolution of modern psychiatry from quite a different perspective. In a sense, we are psychoanalysing psychiatry itself. You may remember this 1967 Rolling Stones hit, Mother's Little Helper, a tongue-in-cheek tribute to a housewife coping with whinging kids and a demanding husband, with a little help from the minor tranquilizer Valium. Well, we'll hear more about psychiatric drugs and women shortly, because my guest today is Jonathan Metzl. He's both a clinical psychiatrist and a cultural historian from the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor in the United States. His ideas are drawn from his vast experience in treating people for depression in his clinic and from looking at modern psychiatry through the lens of gender and culture. Meet Jonathan Metzl.
I should say maybe to start that I'm someone who on one hand is a practitioner of psychiatry. I have a clinic and I treat patients. And on the other hand, I'm somebody who studies the kind of cultural history of the ways that depression came to be seen and thought of in present-day American society, but also internationally. So it's been interesting for me because on one hand, I study pharmaceutical advertisements, representations of depression in film and media and medical writings, and I'm not in any way against the idea that depression has a biological basis, that we have treatments now that are probably better than treatments at other time periods. And so I think that I would be remiss as a practitioner to not see that there has been a great deal of progress in the treatment of depression. And at the same time, as someone who studies this from multiple angles, it also was very interesting for me, especially in the U.S., to see that the kinds of conversations that patients were coming to me with about depression were in part saying, I have depressed mood, I have loss of interest, things like that, that we might say, oh, that's linked to a biological basis. But they were also saying things like, I saw an advertisement for Prozac on television, or I was reading in a newspaper and I saw an article about selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants, or will this help my sex life? Will this help my, you know, role as a parent? All these issues that were very deeply embedded in cultural perceptions and misperceptions. And so it's really been that nexus of what are the relationships between biological understandings of depression and cultural understandings of depression.
Jonathan Metzl. It was during the 50s and 60s that the medical profession began to turn to biological explanations for depression, the idea that's widely held today, that depression is caused by chemical imbalances in the brain. Previous to this, Freudian-based talk therapies were the dominant form of treatment for these types of conditions. In his book, Prozac on the Couch, Prescribing Gender in the Era of Wonder Drugs, Jonathan Metzl tells how this so-called biological revolution meant that depression and related conditions began to be treated with pharmacological drugs.
What I do is tell a history of psychiatric medications in medicine, but also in popular culture. And the book starts in the 1950s, a time when a medication called Miltown became really the first of the modern psychiatric wonder drugs. So we can think about Prozac and maybe now Viagra or something, or the kind of demands. But before the 1950s, these kind of psychiatric wonder drugs really weren't an established phenomenon. And that all changed in 1956 when a medication called Miltown was developed and introduced into the market. And initially, there was a great deal of skepticism among psychiatrists and drug companies because the question was, who's going to go for a medication when we have things like talk therapy. And within 2 months, the demand for Milltown in the United States was so great that there were like these famous signs in the windows of pharmacies saying, "We are out of Milltown, more Milltown tomorrow." And I think by the end of 1957, according to Consumer Reports, a magazine that tracks these, I think 1 in 20 Americans was taking Milltown. And Milton Berle, a famous comedian, renamed himself Milltown Berle as a joke. And so all of a sudden, overnight, not only was a tremendous amount of popular demand for this medication created seemingly out of nowhere, but also this drug became a popular icon, a kind of, you know, like we can think now about Prozac Nation. But in the 1950s, America became a Milltown Nation.
And this was a precursor to the more widely drug, I think, known here, Valium. And Valium was seen as mother's little helper.
Exactly. And so in my study, what I do is really, because I'm somebody who's trained in gender studies as well, look at these medications through the lens of what are the implications for gender. And what I found was that even though we think of Valium as being the mother's little helper, and for very good reason, in part because of the Rolling Stones song, and in part because of the fact that according to some studies, up to 70% of prescriptions for Valium in the United States were written to white middle-class women. But actually, Milltown set the stage for Valium before by creating a set of kind of connections between the anxieties of motherhood, or more aptly, the anxieties that people who were creating a certain kind of public rhetoric had about the role of mothers in society and treatment with psychiatric drugs. And so, for example, I found a great number of articles from Newsweek and Time and other news magazines talking about how women were rebelling against their domestic roles, and they were threatening to take jobs and not give jobs back to returning veterans, etc. And they would always present Milltown as being the treatment for these kind of what were called kind of motherhood problems. And so it was a kind of neat marriage of gender anxieties of the 1950s and a new psychiatric treatment.
So what was happening in relation to psychoanalysis then? Was it actually taking over?
It's a fantastic question, and that's very much a part of the story I tell in the book, because of course psychoanalysis was the dominant paradigm at the time. And so even a very cursory history of psychoanalysis cannot leave out the role of the mother. And so there was a lot of rhetoric in popular culture, in part about Freud and talking cures, but also in relation to gender roles. And so talking about how mothers cause certain symptoms, and there were castrating mothers and frigid mothers and other kinds of mothers. And so what I think I've shown in terms of the ways that these new drugs came about, it's very often argued that this was the beginning of a biological revolution that overthrew Freud. But in looking at the popular representation of these drugs, and particularly the ways they were presented for motherhood problems, I hope to have shown that these drugs were presented as treatments for very psychoanalytic problems, namely these specifically motherhood problems that were very well defined by psychoanalysis.
So what you're saying is that some of the more problematic areas of Freud's theories, especially around gender, remain or are even reinforced.
That is absolutely what I'm saying, that the rhetoric by which these drugs came into being, again, in popular representation, took a lot from Freud, even though the dominant rhetoric was saying we're overthrowing Freud. And so the first chapter of my book is called The Freud of Prozac, for that reason, kind of arguing against this notion that there was this dramatic shift, and actually saying that from the perspective of gender and representation, even while there was a lot of progress that has been made in terms of biology, that in terms of the ways that these drugs are understood in the popular realm, biology owes a lot to Freud with regard to gender.
So where have we got? What have we gained from these two different perspectives, and how are they sitting together?
It's a great question. I actually speak to psychiatric audiences quite a bit, both as a practitioner and as someone who's very sensitive to the issues of psychiatry. I'm not at all saying anything like we've been duped or anything like that. But what I am saying is that there was a shift from a paradigm psychoanalysis that that forced a recognition of a particular form of gender issues and gender awareness. And in theories like transference and countertransference that are two kind of tenets of psychoanalytic theory.
Just explain those.
Of course. The assumption that patients come to psychoanalytic encounters or encounters between doctors and patients with a preconceived set of expectations, primarily around gender, but really around the doctor-patient role. And countertransference are the set of expectations that doctors have about patients, in part based on the interaction, but also based on a long history of, you know, their own personal history. And that in a way, the clinical encounter is shaped by this conversation between transference and countertransference. And what happened in a shift to biology was that we kind of pitched out theories like that and said we don't need to worry about these expectations because we have Prozac. And of course, that's oversimplifying a bit. But the notion was that the interaction became we prescribe a pill and those interpersonal dynamics are not important. And what I argue is actually that even in the briefest of clinical encounters, there still are these preconceived expectations that people bring, not just about doctors and patients, but also about pills. And so I argue that while we need to respect the advances of biology, psychiatry also needs to discover a bit of this transference and countertransference to understand the numerous and multiple and complicated meanings that doctors and patients impute to psychiatric drugs.
So psychoanalytic tools, they remain important as tools in psychoanalysis.
Yeah, in psychoanalysis, but also in society. And so, for example, part of the research that I've done is look at the role of mothers in present-day psychiatric representations. And in the United States, unlike Australia, we have quite a slew of advertisements for antidepressants on television and the radio and internet and seemingly every place else you turn. And so I started looking at those advertisements, and lo and behold, who kept showing up in the advertisements but the mother in different ways. And so, you know, I think that where psychiatry gets into trouble sometimes is by arguing, well, mothers are part of the older paradigm and we don't have to worry about culture or gender, etc. And the point I was making was, well, if that's the case, why is it that the mother keeps showing up in these ads and other kinds of representations?
Just give me an example of the type of wording that has been used in these advertisements.
Well, one ad for Prozac that ran a few years ago had a picture of a mother and then a picture of a basketball later, and the wording was, "Sue is playing with her kids again, just like normal." And then beneath it, it said Prozac. And so it had a few kind of very charged words, and I spent a great deal of time writing about how the assumption is that Prozac restored normal mood, and the word normal was very kind of slippery in a certain kind of way. It restored normal mood, but it also restored Sue to the maternal role in a particular way. And again, I'm not saying that that's in any way a bad thing. I'm just saying that that message has numerous cultural meanings about the relationships between depression and what we might call normative motherhood. And so that on one hand, we want our patients to get better. And at the same time, you know, if you think about numerous examples, maybe someone is in an abusive relationship, they're in a relationship that they don't want, or something like that. There are numerous reasons why Prozac might not be the answer to motherhood problems. But after 2 weeks of writing about this ad, I actually had a patient come into my office and say, "I saw this Sue ad for Prozac, and I realized that Sue is me, and I just want to get back to normal." And at that moment, it was kind of a, okay, am I a cultural historian or am I a psychiatrist? And I think that the wrong answer would have actually been to say, well, what you're looking at is a socially constructed phenomenon, and what we need to do is to change the culture rather than treat the individual. I think that answer would have been malpractice. Instead, I think what I realized at that moment and others like that is that actually social and cultural forces give meaning to individual expressions of symptoms. And so my answer at that time was, it seemed for all the world that it was a yes-no decision, yes Prozac or no Prozac. But I think a better answer is, tell me what in the ad you respond to. What is it about, you know, your life, your assumptions about motherhood? What are your expectations about the ways that Prozac might help? In other words, I'm not saying reject ads. I'm saying that ads actually tap into expectations in their viewers that are important for doctors and patients to talk about. Doctor, please.
You're with All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and you may be listening on your MP3 player. I'm Lynn Malcolm, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Metzl from the University of Michigan in the United States. In his study of American advertisements for psychiatric drugs and articles in popular magazines, he found gender stereotypes in the portrayal of conditions like depression. And he even suggests that the way these drugs are depicted in popular culture may well be changing our definitions of some psychological conditions.
That's absolutely true. And so when you start advertising medications, for example, you know, they get tapped up with desire and expectation and sexuality and a whole host of other factors. And I think those are, again, important for doctors and patients to know about. And so in the US, well, there's one school of thought that says we should just outlaw these advertisements. And I don't really take a stand either way. I also say that the advertisers are actually very astute in paying attention to these kind of cultural trends.
And there are also other examples in with different drugs, like you've referred at one stage to Ritalin and hyperactivity in children. Just explain how it's worked in that area.
Well, it's really, again, there are fantastic scholars working on the area of Ritalin, and it is not a drug that I study historically, but I use it as an example to talk about the ways in which our expectation of normal versus treatable illness has shifted. And so in the case of Ritalin, I argue that actually the presence of Ritalin and the wide availability of Ritalin actually shifted the categories of normal versus pathological childhood. So whereas, again, to overgeneralize, in the pre-Ritalin days, we might say little Johnny is just eating too much sugar cereal for breakfast and he'll calm down by third period or something like that. In today's age, we would say, well, little Johnny needs some Ritalin. And so there's a shift from a kind of, you know, in the former example, being a kind of rhetoric of Johnny is acting out, but he's within the realm of the norm, to the latter category of, oh, there's a treatment available for this, and we've shifted Johnny into the pathological category. And so it's really a term that I use a lot called medicalization, in which the boundaries of the illness expand outward and often do so in response to psychiatric drug treatments.
You've also given a presentation while you've been here on this issue of medicalization, and that the images of medicalization are not just perpetuated by the media. Can you just explain your findings there?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a series of two studies that I talked about. The first study, I tracked the expansion of gender stereotypes in relation to antidepressant conversations and articles in the media. And so what I did in the first study was to look at popular articles about depression from the 100 leading U.S. magazines and newspapers by circulation and look at the ways that depression was talked about in these articles. And what we found, I worked on this with several of my students back at Michigan, was that in 85, 2 years before Prozac came out, there were very few gender stereotypes associated with conversations about antidepressants. And then that's different than, you know, Mother's Little Helper, which were anti-anxiety drugs. But in terms of antidepressant articles, there wasn't much going on. And what we saw was that as Prozac became available, and as people started asking for Prozac and supply and demand expanded, that what we saw were an expanding set of very gender-specific stereotypes in the ways depression was described in the media.
Family life. Although not everyone with postpartum depression needs drugs to get better, some women may not recover without them, which could explain why women of our mother's generation often medicated themselves with Valium and martinis.
We saw that for women, overwhelmingly, over the course of this period, 85 to 2000, women's depression came to be described in popular articles in relation to the women's roles as mothers or being married or menstruation also came up quite a bit. We ended up calling these the three M's. And we would see articles like a woman was feeling depressed and she couldn't cook breakfast for her children and she couldn't do any of the housework and she went and saw a doctor for some Prozac. Or one was, is it PMS or are you in a really bad mood? Or other articles really talked about how depression made women unable to play with their children. And again, not that this is in any way a bad thing, but it was very specific about the kinds of women shown in these articles. And so we would see basically almost overwhelmingly white women between 19 and 45 being described in these articles, and very little about women's depression impacting their work, for example. So nothing about, here's a working woman who is depressed and can't go to her job.
Ladies' Home Journal. Nancy McCutcheon, 35, of Stockbridge, Georgia, has been taking Prozac for 2 years to ease PMS, moodiness, and insomnia, and she says the drug saved her family. Prozac doesn't totally eliminate my PMS, but it's nothing I can't handle.
For men, it was almost exactly the opposite story. For men, there was almost nothing about men getting depressed and it impacting their roles as fathers or as boyfriends or as anything that might imply emotions or inner lives and, you know, hardly anything going on. But for men, actually, the categories of depression that came to be represented in these popular articles related to aggression, athletics, sports, and to a little bit lesser extent work. And so we would see articles about famous athletes who got depressed and couldn't win races or hit the ball or something, and then they would take Prozac and they would start winning again.
The Observer sports page, Inside Edge, Salazar running on Wonder Drug. Alberto Salazar's days as a great runner were far behind him until his remarkable victory in the Comrades Marathon in South Africa this year. He has an even bigger shock for the athletics world. He runs legally on the new wonder drug, Prozac.
And what we started to see was that over time, there were very clear parameters about the ways you could and could not talk about depression that were almost unconscious. It's not like we thought this was volitional. And so stories about women's depression in relation to motherhood were very, I mean, we found them very readily. Same thing for men. If it was aggression, athletics, sports, or work, we found that those trends were very strongly positive. But it was also interesting for us what was being left out: men's emotions, women's work, persons of color, gay and lesbian issues. A whole host of issues were so counter to the kind of popular narrative.
Time magazine, Pills for the Mind. After medication, the woman went home on a maintenance dose of one pill a day. Her husband had only one complaint. She'd become so demanding in her newfound love for him that he wondered whether the doctors could make the pills a bit smaller.
So what do you think is required to shift? It really feels like we haven't got very far at all when you speak like this. What's required to shift that attitude?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned that it was a two-part study. The second part of the study that has yet to be published, we've just finished our analysis, was that we then did the same coding scheme and applied it to physician dictations of medical charts, basically, and psychiatric charts at the hospital that I work at, University of Michigan Hospital. And what we found was that actually the same trends pretty much were happening in the doctor's descriptions of patients. And so what we would see is that between 85 and 2000, doctors were much more likely to talk about women's depression and describe it when they dictated the medical chart in terms of these women's roles as mothers. And for men, the men's descriptions, similar to popular media, very often appeared, the doctor would dictate and say, Bob is a 35-year-old man who's having a hard time concentrating at work and he can't get his writing done or he can't drive his truck or something like that. And it was never, Bob is feeling depressed and he can't take care of his children. And conversely for women, we saw a lot of, she is tearful and this is impacting her relationship. And so that narrative seems to open up a host of different questions. The fact that we saw similar trends in the media and the medical charts, I think, suggests that this process of medicalization, for better and for worse, happens in language. It happens in everyday speech. It happens in the ways that we just kind of interpret the world in a way. And so I think that that's both a good thing and a bad thing, because I think that it's easier to say we need to block advertisements, we need to lock the doors, we need to have tight controls over the media. But actually, I think that in today's day and age, doctors and patients need to be very self-aware about the kind of expectations and desires encapsulated by psychiatric drugs, and to be able to talk about them whether or not a drug is prescribed.
Psychiatrist and cultural historian Jonathan Metzl. And he's now in the early stages of another project looking at stereotypes of mental illness in popular culture, but this time he's focusing on race. It's called Protest Psychosis: Race, Stigma and Schizophrenia.
It led us to the question of what's the other side of the story. And of course, there are conditions in the U.S. that have been historically overdiagnosed, particularly in African-American men. And schizophrenia is definitely at the top of that list. And so convincing studies going back to the 1970s talk about the way in which schizophrenia is an illness that, even though if you made a genetic argument, you would say schizophrenia should appear in 1% of the world's population, irregardless of race, class, geographic location. But in contrast, African-American men in the U.S. are anywhere from 4 to 7 times more likely to be overdiagnosed. In other words, for every one diagnosis of schizophrenia in somebody else, 4 to 7 African-American men are diagnosed. Obviously flies in the face of these genetic findings. And what I'm doing in the new project is trying to tell the history of those numbers and explain from a historical perspective why that might be the case.
Okay, just to finish off, I guess as implied in the title of your book, Prozac on the Couch, what you're actually doing is analysing modern psychiatry. What's your diagnosis?
I think that there's tremendous progress right now for psychiatry, because far from being a Luddite, I'm actually very supportive of the progress that psychiatry has made in terms of accuracy of diagnosis, treatment options that are available. I think there have been great advances in terms of understanding, as we were talking about before, the biological basis of illness and also of personhood more broadly. Now I think it's time to embed those findings in more holistic understandings or social and cultural understandings that are possibly, you know, we can certainly take a lesson from psychiatry's past about the ways in which the treatments that we offer, like Prozac, actually are tremendously powerful cultural symbols that have their own transference and countertransference. And so I think that now that we are making such great strides with regard to the biological basis, we also might step back and say, how can we understand biological personhood within the context of social or cultural personhood? And I think that that justifies, I think it's to psychiatry's detriment to say we see people for 5 minutes and we just write quick prescriptions. I think it's much better to say we can provide prescriptions, but we also understand holistically the issues that arise in a personal interaction. And so we understand the psychoanalysis of Prozac in a way.
Now, it's 150 years since the birth of Sigmund Freud. How would you assess the legacy of Sigmund Freud in today's psychiatry?
Well, there have been quite a few tributes to Freud, and rightly so, recently. And I guess I would just say that in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there rightfully was a backlash against psychoanalysis and psychiatry for numerous reasons, one of which was there was difficulty proving the efficacy of treatments, and the treatments were expensive and exclusive and not available for everyone. And so the shift to biology is in part a shift to say we can treat many more people and do so in ways that we can prove. And at that time, there was a rhetoric basically saying the death of Freud. You know, you could see that in any number of publications. Freud is dead, and long live the new biology. And as someone who's a historian, of course, I have to make this argument, but there's no such thing as a clean cut in history. And actually, for worse, but also for better, psychiatry, unlike other professions, does have a legacy of understanding particularly issues of gender and context and other issues that give us a science of how to talk to people in a way. And so I would say that that tradition is alive in certain aspects of psychiatry and also has something to teach psychiatry more broadly as a profession.
Thank you, Jonathan Metzl.
Terrific. Thanks so much. It's been wonderful to be here.
Jonathan Metzl, and he was in Australia recently as a visiting fellow at the University of Sydney. He holds a joint appointment in psychiatry and women's studies at the University of Michigan, where he's also director of the program Culture, Health and Medicine. His book, Prozac on the Couch, Prescribing Gender in the Era of Wonder Drugs, is published by Duke University Press. For more information and audio files of our recent programs, visit our New Look website at abc.net.au/rn and choose All in the Mind in the program list. Thanks to producer Sherry DeLeese and sound engineer Michelle Goldsworthy. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Next week, the first of a two-part series on Aboriginal mental health. I'll be speaking with some community members and mental health workers on one of the Tiwi Islands, north of Darwin. See you then.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.